This is Whiskey and Words. I'm David Olson, and I'm joined today by writer John Campbell. Morning, John.
Hello.
John's here to share one of his stories with us and discuss a bit about the process and about origins and such. Mm-hmm. And throughout, we're also going to have a drink of Laphroaig, 10-year-old.
Laphroaig.
Which will be lovely and smoky for a Saturday morning, I think. So welcome, John. How are you today? You doing
good? I'm good, thank you.
Very good, very good. So we met a little while ago now in the writing group that I'm making famous by now, talking about it so much. And I've heard you share some of your work, and I'm a big fan, and you cover a lot of different topics, which are quite exciting. And the story you've got today is quite a nice sort of personal kind of family piece, isn't it? Which is quite exciting. So when it comes to writing, where did you start? What did you start with? What type of, I've heard you read for the stage. I've heard you read short prose. I've heard some different things. What's your favorite thing, but also where did you start with it?
My impetus for writing comes mostly from something that needs exercising, I think. Often derived from a mixture of therapy and subjects that come up really in that. I work in mental health. I've always had an interest in psychotherapy and psychology, and so the reason I write is because I'm interested in relationships and my own process. I don't consciously do it to be published, or I just feel like there's something I want to put together really and explore, and I love sharing it with the group really. It's part of that. The format, I think I tend to write prose more, to be honest. And that feels a little bit more comfortable. When we first met, I tried a play, which was an interesting experiment for me, but I had less of an opportunity to create a world, I think, which I quite like to do. Now I feel more comfortable in a kind of prose place.
Cool. I think you're right. There's always a story to be told, and different people have got different stories, and you just kind of want to get it out there. It's a good reason to start writing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's cool. I think that, yeah, I mean, you mentioned trying those different things, and the stage play, you didn't want to go down that route as much. You wanted to move into the prose. I enjoyed that stage play, though. I did. You're right, it was good.
Is that encouragement, Dave?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those few things. Like, I always talk about, I spend more time on this podcast talking about things that I don't write than what I do. But it's one thing I've always wanted to try is writing for stage. Because I've written short film scripts, and I've written prose and various other things, but I don't understand the stage. I think that's why I can't really write for it.
Yeah.
So did you have a background in acting and performing?
Yeah, I've done a lot of amateur dramatics from a young age. And I think I understand the stage, but it's quite hard to write a play nevertheless, because you never know quite how it's going to be read or performed. There's a text, but each performance is different, what comes out, and actually seeing your words come alive or read by someone else, and the many, many different ways that they can be delivered. I think that's an interesting and exciting way to go with writing, which is different from prose.
Yeah.
I'm a control freak, however. I probably quite prefer to either direct my own plays or writing prose. Actually, it probably gives me a bit more control.
Yeah. Well, no. I was saying before that when we were talking about reading through your work that you sent across me for today's recording. And although I'd heard you read this story before, of course, when I read it, it sounded very different.
Oh, okay.
And I imagine, but you know, I think the emotion behind it and sort of the weight of what you're telling still lands the same way. Just, of course, I'm reading it in my voice as opposed to what I'm used to hearing in yours.
Mm.
And I think that you're right. If you're writing for the stage and suddenly you give it to somebody who is interpreting it in their own voice, then it's very different, because they're going to then pay people play out their version, I guess. Whereas at least with prose, you hand it to them, and if they interpret it differently, it's in their own head. And they're not going to be changing the message behind it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Well, would you care for a drink?
Yes, okay. As you're pouring, as I explained, whiskey is very relevant for the theme of the story, which is about a relationship between a father and a son. And I am a Campbell, and my father is Scottish, and have grown up Burns nights every year. In fact, we're not too far from Burns, are we? That's the 26th, I think, so we're the 14th. Yeah. So having drinking this every year, really, and kind of what you inherit from his culture and what you do with what you inherit is how far you wear his identity or your own is the theme of the story. So the whiskey is very relevant.
Good to hear.
I'm going to have a wee bit of water course, of with course. It.
Cheers.
Almost lounge. Well, that's not bad.
I always started off saying that I didn't like Islay whiskies. Too smoky, too much
it's
there.
It's very smoky, isn't it?
And then I have had more as time has gone on, and I just like them more and more, which is just... It's insane how your palate changes and suddenly like, actually, no, I do actually quite like them. Yeah. I quite like it as an evening drink, because it's got kind of smoky, kind of warming winter feeling to it, I always think. But
That's probably the most successful whiskey drinking I've had for some time. It's a good couple of years since I've drunk. That's really nice. I get the smokiness for sure. I think they smoke the peat, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
The peat.
The peat. Well, I'm glad to hear that it's going down well.
Yes. I'll gently sup it during our journey. We're all on a journey, Dave.
I agree. So, speaking of that journey, do you want to take us on it right now?
Yes. I'm going to read you a short story called In His Hands. I hold his hand. I have time to study it in close detail. The chunky wedding ring seems heavy on his finger and has worn the skin hard on his palm underneath. There is a fringe of hair on the back of his hand, a couple of moles. I suppose I knew they had always been there, but this is the closest to his hand I had been since I was a boy. The hand toiled, had been covered in engine grease, had scrambled around in mud on the Falkland Islands. This hand had held a gun, pulled a trigger, raised a salute, and fixed a bayonet. This hand had held me, bathed me, and stroked my hair when I was sick. This hand had beaten me, grabbed me, thrown me around, and held me down when I tried to get away. I run my fingers over the veins which cascade down the back of it, proud over the tendons and the knuckles. This hand has a life and a presence of its own, despite the body now being old, wizened, and dying. It is the closest I have come to this hand. Just down from the hand is his father's watch. Time ticking down through the generations, the gold warm and the face worn by years before his own. It seems to dwarf him, clunky about the bones where his hand no longer has the muscle it once had. I could slip a finger between the strap and the arm. My father had been obsessed with the time his whole life. The hour of the family departure barked at dawn before our holiday, a countdown every 10 minutes thereafter until we have to have our asses out the door. We always left an hour early in case we broke down too. Not that we ever did. Dinner was at 1700 hours every night. And there was never enough hours in the day for him to get done what he needed to get done. Yet he still found the time to take me for a bike ride every Sunday, to stop at my favourite park, and to sit together with some sandwiches by the duck pond. Now he's running out of time. They say he only has a few weeks to live. I squeeze his hand, but nothing comes back. The ventilator and heart machine ticks on indifferently. I study his face and shut his eyes, flickering in a dream behind the lids. There wasn't much he didn't see when I was younger. He could tell from my face when I was lying, whether I had cleaned my room or not, folded my trousers, or snuck out after everyone had gone to bed. He had ears and eyes everywhere. Constant surveillance, in the name of my safety. We lived in a state of his fear, the latest bomb warnings from Ireland, behind barbed wire and camouflage. Once, playing war with the street kids, I borrowed his field jacket and proudly displayed his chardonnay stripes to all my mates, and wielded my plastic gun like I fucking owned the street. Then I was caught in the bushes by him. The enemy hurled me back home and lectured me on the danger of terrorists who would love nothing more than the prize of a squaddy brat. Then I was just following orders which I didn't believe in, but didn't dare challenge. It was only now, in intensive care, fighting for his life, that the dangers of his world felt more real to me. How frail and worn down he looks in his hospital bed, a shadow of the soldier which inhabited my memory. I continue to hold his hand and I squeeze it again. A tear wells behind his left eye. I don't remember him crying, not even at his dad's funeral, as I stood aged 5 beside him. Later he told me that he was numb, that he felt he had to be strong for his mother who was left behind. He didn't cry, but he had a lot to say about his father, a soldier and a veteran before him. Sunday afternoon films about World War II were always inspected by tales of my granddad being captured in the war, jumping from a plane and all the technical details of the operation. I could tell from the level of detail and the intrigue that his father's story mattered to him. He could tell you hour by hour, movement by movement, what had happened to the regiments. Though he survived the war, every Remembrance Sunday my dad would attend church and grieve for his father as though he had died during the war, along with the comrades of his own conflicts. He spent hours polishing his medals and his shoes the night before, every year. Even after he had left the army, he polished his shoes like they were boots, you know. I can remember those boots. The ritual of lacing them up in the morning, the thick, heavy thud of them down on the floor, coming down the hallway to me. Playing on the floor, once, those boots had destroyed the station from my train set and bent the toy soldiers waiting to board the next troop transporter. The bent officers joined the mutilated soldiers he had decapitated or torn limb from limb with a lawnmower in the garden. He would polish my school shoes every weekend just like his boots, with spit, with an old toothbrush in the back garden. Every Monday I would kick as many walls as I could on the way to school and scuff them again. I suppose I wanted to kick him, but I wouldn't dare. So that was the closest I got. There are no boots now, no medals, and no uniform. There is an unwashed old body, an unceremonious hospital gown with white sheets and a bedpan. He wouldn't be watching out for me anymore. He wouldn't be standing guard, but he wouldn't be trapping me in his sight to protect me from the dangers of his imagination either. The doctors are observing him every hour, and they think his lungs are about to pack up. It would be so easy to up the morphine, to turn off the machine, and to have done with this man. My finger lingers on the morphine dial, and a shot of adrenaline rushes through my veins at the power I have to end him. I stop myself. I stand up to get a coffee and stretch my legs. And then I catch sight of my face hovering in the window among the flashing lights of the machines next to me. I can see his cheeks, his eyes, and the shape of his skull looking back at me. I sigh and walk out the room. He will die, but that soldier lives on inside me, ready to defend himself and dig in against my attack. I walk down the corridor to the coffee machine, listening to the sound of his life support behind me, and trying to work out what to do with the watch that he has left me in his will.
Thank you for that. I really enjoyed that story. And again, I always say that when I've listened to what is quite a sad tale. And I feel like I need to clarify that I enjoyed the tale and not necessarily the sadness within it. No, but I like that a lot. And I think that some of the things that stood out for me, one in particular was the kind of the mix of emotions in your main character. And the way it's sort of, they're both half, almost it seems kind of triumphant and also quite broken at the same time with it. And so they're sort of managing that kind of balance. Did you find that a challenge? Or were there any sort of earlier drafts or versions of the story where your character kind of went either way?
The reason for writing was that conflict between the compassion and the anger. So, in a father-son relationship, and both were there from the start. And the bit with the morphine at the end and the finger on the morphine dial is that temptation to be sadistic to end him. But the real pain is the fact that he identifies with, can see the father within. And I didn't have, there's some changes, but not many earlier drafts. And simply to write a rant, which is full of rage, or a bleeding heart for a dead father, wouldn't have brought out that the interest, the complexity of that relationship.
Yeah.
For me.
No, I agree. I agree. I think that the way you balance those together makes it a really compelling tale. And if it was just someone reeling against their, you know, their overbearing father or crying their eyes out, it wouldn't have that same pull, would it? I don't think. No, and you've done it very well. No, that works. I think the focus on the hands was the thing as well. Obviously, that's how it starts. I quite like that blend of kind of toughness and sensitivity. The idea that this man has been toiling in the mud, he's been stroking his hair. You know, there's that kind of that balance between those two things as well. So did the story start with the relationship, or did it start with the idea of that moment with the hands? And
it started with that moment.
Okay.
I suppose I have had my own difficulties with my my body and my identity, and noticing that certain parts of my own body resemble other people. But noticing that my hands are quite like his. And I used to wear a wedding ring. And I can kind of still sort of see, there's still a little bit of, it feels like there's, it looks like there's a hard bit of flesh still where the ring used to be.
Yeah.
And then thinking about what I've inherited from my father. And it's a very, very physical, like I carry this hand around with me every day. And that's what it came from, really. And then grew into thinking, like you say, like hands are instrumental. There's a potency, but there's a care as well, and it's that mix between how the same hand, same object is used in both ways.
Yeah,
and it grew from that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to find the inspiration coming from something like that, because it's something that I think a lot of people kind of respect as truth. You know, you have similarities with family and all the rest of it, but it doesn't always inspire a further thought about it. You know, I bear a great resemblance to my father, but I don't often think about what that means for me because of the fact that I look in a mirror and I can see him. I don't, you know, I that part of the story, that looking and catching that reflection, seeing the same things,
yeah.
You know, I have that. But I don't, I think it's easy to pass by that and just be kind of like, oh yeah, resemblance, no big deal. And not to think about the weight that could carry. Especially if you, like with this character, if you have quite mixed feelings towards that person, and then you are bearing that as well, I can imagine that being, you know, quite the challenge for people, but one that people don't always consider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Process of how you become yourself, your own man, when you've inherited a lot from your own parents. That's the stuff that is often the impetus for a lot of my writing.
Yeah. Well, I did notice, I mean, obviously having heard this and reading this separately, and also hearing other things that you've written before.
Yeah.
Relationships generally play quite a large part
mm-hmm.
in your writing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something, do you feel that can be the most sort of interesting thing for a character to explore? Or is it more a belief that kind of personal development is driven by relationships with others?
It's my own narcissism. It's my own interest in my relationships, and the fiction that I write is thinly veiled. You discover yourself in your relationship with others. I'm kind of aware for any family that might listen to this that it's my own stuff. It's and I love writing as a vehicle for that.
Mm.
What's interesting about our writing group, I think, and in this very podcast, is that it opens up the relationships that I share bits of myself which remain hidden, but very close to the surface. Why I like fiction more, I think, than writing the dialogue or doing a play, is that I can bring in the psychological, the thought, the stuff that's inside more easily.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. It's very hard to write psychology for the stage, is it? Because the character's got to put that across for you, but you can't explicitly say things so much, and you can't put them across in a way that's as clear for the audience, I guess.
Oh, it's a different skill.
One that, sadly, I don't possess. Maybe eventually. Eventually.
Yeah.
But no, I like that. I like that very much. I like the difficulty in this particular relationship.
Mm.
Because I think that there's an eagerness for people to simplify and dumb down how people interact with each other and how those relationships can help someone, whether it's developing emotionally, whether it's developing physically and appearance and things.
Mm.
People, it's very easy to discount how big an impact that can have on somebody.
Mm. Mm.
And I like in this one that the character is appreciating how big that impact is and working that through in their own mind in these quite pivotal moments for them as well. Yeah. I think that one thing I saw is it showcases your dexterity for switching things up a little bit and for changing around. I mean, you've got this sort of a fearsome patriarch who's become a frail old man.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a child who occasionally kind of hated their father, has now grown sentimental about what's left behind and what there'll be.
Mm-hmm.
Was it challenging to keep it switched up that way? Or was it like a great opportunity to showcase how someone can have these two different sides?
Showcase is an interesting word. I didn't set out to show off skill, but I think the way I read, I'm interested in that, just those deep moments of being, and the way I read, there is a conscious performance of, this is the tender stuff. There's a very fine line between the craft of writing and the content. And I enjoy the craft, of course. I probably more see the writing as a vehicle to let myself be known. Craft comes into it, of course. It's nice to, this is an exaggeration of parts of my life and people in my life. And I quite like to get people's heartstrings pulled.
Yeah.
There's this like magician type quality. It's just like, I can't, look at me bringing this out here. But I think it's a desperation to be known. And at the same time, I could have just written a diary entry and said, this is what it's like for me. So it's an interesting desperation to be known, but there's a certain element of hiding as well.
Yeah. Well, you can be quite true to yourself in what you write, but also there's a, no matter what it is, there is that veneer of, this is fiction. And if anyone who didn't know you or anything else could read that story, and take, or any story for that matter, and take the whole thing as, this is entirely fiction.
Yeah.
Or you could pick up any book off any shelf and think, hang on, how much of the author is in this?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the powerful things about prose, is that you have that kind of, it could be either, you don't know which one it is,
mm-hmm.
but you allow the reader to make the assumption.
Yeah. Hiding in plain sight, I think, is what I enjoy about writing, art, music, the psychology of that, really desperately wanting to be known, but wanting to hide at the same time. Yeah.
So along with this, and I know I've heard some of your shorter pieces before, and I've mentioned that stage play. I know that you're working on a novel at the moment,
mm-hmm.
which we don't have to share today, but maybe at one point in the future, who knows? We'll have a retrospective episode. but with that in mind, and it's a question I tend to ask everybody because it fascinates me. When it comes to those different types of writing, the sort of much longer form in a novel,
yeah.
you know, a stage. I mean, you've already made your views on that stage part quite clear anyway. And then that compared to the shorts, do you have a preferred method to put those stories across out of those ones that you choose? Or do you think the story dictates what it needs to be?
I do feel it's a bit more like the story. That was an image based on the hand, which seems kind of like a motif feel for me. With the novel, I really wanted to develop the complexities of overlapping relationships between couples, and so that naturally kind of grew and grows into a bigger piece. There's a certain amount of stamina. It's quite exhausting to bear the weight of writing a lot of words as well, and I think if I wanted a quick emotional fix, I get really excited about a chapter. It's actually the discipline of, all right, it's great to have these amazing windows, so I've got to put some bricks in here, and then I need to build up the foundations there, and sun's coming through the roof, so I probably ought to patch that in. It's a,
yeah.
It's a really interesting house, but it takes you a long time to decide what pictures to put where or whatever. That's my metaphor. But
well, I like that metaphor. I think you're right. I think it is.
As we sat in your most glorious house, it just comes to mind.
No, I like the idea of, I think it's a very good metaphor, the idea that there's a lot of, when it comes to writing, there's a lot of things that are nice to do, and there's nice things to put in there. And you know, and I'm the same, and I've mentioned before, I've worked on novels, I've worked on things, and they've never really gone anywhere because I don't have the patience, I don't have the dedication that you need to have to produce something like that.
Yep.
Because I get bogged down in, this is a nice bit, I'll work on this bit. And then it's like, okay, well, I need to write 3 chapters that get there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't really want to do that,
yep.
So I'll go back to this. So, no, I can see that. That's why most of my work is less than 1,000 words, because it's very hard to get distracted from that, generally.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, I enjoyed that story a lot, and I enjoy your exploration of relationships and emotion. I think that you have a very considered, a very careful way of doing it, which never comes across as overly bleeding heart. It never comes across as cold. It never, and you always manage to find that quite nice balance in the middle, which is why I'm a fan. And I think that, you know, whether it's to be showcased or not, I think, you know, I hope that it will be more so because I enjoy it very much.
Thank you. There's a certain amount of finding some confidence in my voice, I think, which needs to happen and grow, I think, in order for me to develop, put my writing out there more.
Mm.
It has been a private habit behind closed doors in firmly shut books. And the group is the first time that I've shared and shown it, actually. It's been great.
Yeah. Well, long may it continue.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah. But I want to say thank you very much for being here today, for being a part of this. Thank you for your story. And I do hope that we'll find a way to get that out more into the world and we can see more of those, because you've got great stories to tell. So, and if you do, make sure you tell me so I can find them.
Cheers, Dave.
Yes, thank you. Thank you to Lilla Freud Distillery. That
yes.
was a nice little smoky drop, too.
It was.
Yeah.
A nice wee dram.
Indeed. But thank you very much. And thank you to the listeners. And we will see you all again next time.